Good evening. Can you hear me? You can hear me?
Yep.
I hope it lasts, because I went to the doctor on Friday, and they put me through all these breathing tests, and had a lot of trouble breathing from there on. They're supposedly helping me. My name is Ray Champagne, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Ray.
And like Rick said last week, I celebrated 36 years. My anniversary is July of 1981. Now, looking around the room, and we've got people in here that probably have anywhere from a few days to a week or whatever. It's a Jerry up here with 42, I think 42, right? 41. You're coming up on 42, though. Pretty quick.
February.
If you live that long. You know, well, see, that's what happens. If you don't die and you don't drink, you get a lot of years, you know. Kathy's got 40, you know. Okay. For me to tell my story, it's kind of dull and boring. I did a lot of drinking. I got drunk. I abused everybody in my life. I got sober, and here I am. That is really the short version of it. The longer version is I was born in Rhode Island. Not Long Island, Rhode Island. I am a real Yankee. Came down here in 96, I moved here. I was with a company called Boston Market. And that's what I did. I ran all of Boston Market. So I moved down here from Philadelphia in 96, and I've been here ever since. So I'm one of those what they call damn Yankees. I didn't leave. Opened my own place in 1999 and ran that for 10 years until gas hit $4 a gallon. That put me out of business. But anyway, as a young man, I went to Catholic high school, paid my own tuition, worked my way through, was on the sports teams, met my wife, who is still my wife, when I was 16. And we've been married coming up on 48 years in September. Now, remember, that's a long time, but we split up many times in there, and we filed for divorce several times, and we've been through it. I can't even begin to tell you we've been through it. Hopefully when I talk a little bit more, you'll see what happened. When I was in high school, I got to work for a country club. And I was a responsible young man, so they gave me the keys to the liquor cabinet and to the whole liquor storeroom. And by the time I was 18, I was drinking a lot because it was free. And what else are you going to do at 18 when it's free? So I was drinking the good stuff then. You know, it was regal. It was free. I'm not drinking anything, no junk. I worked my way through high school, went through college. By the time I was in college, I used to have a cooler in the back seat of my car all the time full of beer, just all the time. In the dead of winter, it was full of ice so it wouldn't freeze, and in the summer, it was full of ice so it wouldn't go warm. And that's a trick, by the way. If you keep beer and ice in the winter, it will not freeze. Cold up there, not so cold down here. When I graduated, we were in quite a recession. I graduated in 1970. Yeah, 70. So I stayed working in the restaurant business. I've been in the restaurant business pretty much all my life. There are a couple of little twists and turns in there, but most of it's all got to do with food and restaurants. I work for a company called Valley Steakhouse. Anybody from up north might know that. There were 28 of them up and down the East Coast. And I worked every day with an older man by the name of Mr. Valley. Did my training in Rhode Island, then I went up to Massachusetts and worked with him on a daily basis. And he's the one that taught me the restaurant business. I mean, really taught me the restaurant business. And he used to say to me, Ray, you know, if you just wouldn't drink so much. His son was an alcoholic, and he couldn't get his son to stop, so he used to work on me. My father used to say the same thing. If you just wouldn't drink so much. A lot of people in my life said the same thing. You're a nice guy, but you just drink too much. Well, they were right. But at the time, you couldn't have convinced me that they were right. There was nothing that they could have said that would have convinced me. By the time I stopped, I was drinking about 17 hours a day. I was drinking up at 5 o'clock in the morning, driving into Philadelphia. Still get up at 5 o'clock in the morning on Wednesdays, but now we go to a meeting. But I was working in Philadelphia, so I'd drink all the way in, and then I used to bring my briefcase in to, I ran the dietary department in a big Center City hospital, and I had my briefcase. In my briefcase was a six-pack of beer, a bottle of bourbon, and two pencils. I have no idea why I carried the two pencils, but I knew why. I had a six-pack of beer fanned out and a bottle, and it just fit in there just nicely, six that way and a bottle. And that came in, and then I put it next to my desk, and when nobody was looking, it got put into the desk. And that's how I did it every day. And then when I get out, I went across the street, and I got a six-pack because I had to drive home. And by the time I'd get home, it was a two-pack. And then I'd go to the garage or the gas station or whatever they call it down here, and they had friends that I drank with, so we'd get another couple of six-packs. By the time I get home from work, it was 7 o'clock, and my wife said, "You've been drinking?" I said, "Yeah, I had a couple of beers." Had a couple of beers in the last half hour, but all day long I probably had 12 and a quarter of a bottle of bourbon. So I was always loaded. Never drunk, never falling down, but always, always, always at a level of alcohol that I was never sober. So if I stood up here and told you my whole life of drinking was bad, I'd be lying. I had a lot of good years drinking, especially when we were younger. My wife and I drank together. A lot of you know my wife. She'd been in program for 33 years. And before that, she went into Al-Anon 2 years before I stopped. So she's been around the programs from, in fact, when she went from Al-Anon and started going to AA meetings, I went ballistic. You know, I thought she was trying to hone in on my territory. So, you know, why are you going to AA meetings? You're not an alcoholic. You know, when we were young, I always liked it when she was drinking because it made my life a lot easier. I'd make her what I'd say a highball. Well, a highball was in a Tupperware glass. It was 20 ounces and like 4 or 5 ounces of booze and some ginger ale and a few ice cubes. So every time I'd made her a drink, she had four. Three anyway, but probably four. And I liked it when she was half lit. We had a good time. Those good times started to go away. I truly believe I have an addictive personality. I'd be addicted to horse crap if I get high on it, I would have done it. But if it, you know, chocolate, cigarettes, booze, didn't make any difference. Sex, gambling, it's all, you know, whatever can make me feel good, that's what I want, and I want as much of it as I can get. We still do, had a son who's now he's 47, and he just said the other day, he said, "You know, Dad, I'm so glad you stopped drinking. I'm glad you didn't die." And he meant it. He was down here visiting with his wife and one of his kids. And for my son to say that to me, it meant a lot. Because when he was 4 or 5 years old, my wife's favorite song for me is Desperado, and she sings it, usually on my anniversary. And my son one of the lines from that song is, he used to say, "Dad, you need to open your gate." Well, he didn't know what he was talking about. But what he was saying is, I had a fence around me, and I never opened my gate and let him or my wife or anybody in. It was, you know, if I was drunk, then, you know, that's where I was. And I didn't have to talk. I didn't have to communicate. Didn't have to do anything. It was just, I could have just... Just this past weekend, we had a problem with our sewer, and when they were fixing it, they cut my cable, and I had to go the whole weekend with no cable, which means I had to talk to my wife the whole damn weekend. And it's for real. It's a long stretch, not being able to do the remote, and you know, I'm watching the news, you know, you can't do that when there's no television. We finally broke out a couple of DVDs and watched Dirty Dancing and some other stuff. It was, but I mean, too many hours of no distraction was killing us. Well, anyway, excuse me, I'm hoping his throat's going to hold off. During my final years of drinking, I stopped drinking when I was 33 years old. And I used to tell her when we were younger, I'd say, "I'm going to die at 33. You know, if it was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me. I'm going to die at 33, and that's my plan." And I kind of meant it, but I don't know how much I meant it. I used to say it all the time. But during those last few years, and for a lot of years after I stopped drinking, I was abusive. financially, emotionally, physically, verbally. If there's a way you can abuse a person, I did it. I was just nasty. And I'd say that goes for a lot of years in sobriety. A lot of years. Worried about a lot of things. I always blamed her for stuff. I still do sometimes. Sometimes it is her fault, but most of the time it's mine. I got involved with pornography, and that ruined everything. You know, it just does. It's rampant in today's society. I would say I was totally addicted to it. And, you know, any guy that thinks that it's just okay and everybody does it, they can come and talk to me sometime, and I'll let them know what's really going on with that stuff. Because every time you're using pornography, you're cheating on your wife. I mean, you just are. So it took me a long time to get through that. But in 1981, I finally decided that I needed to stop drinking or I was going to die. I didn't know at the time, but when they finally checked me, my blood pressure was over 200. I was bleeding from every orifice of my body. I was as red as that cup, and probably weighed about 245 or 250. I've taken 3 and 4 showers a day, and I still stunk. My feet were so bad I had to put the shoes outside at night. I mean, just my body was just crazy. It was sweating and dirty, and booze was coming out of every pore in my body. Blood probably was coming out the pores too. I couldn't see that, but I know it was coming out the rest of me. That's for sure. So I made a reservation to go into a place called Valley Forge Hospital and detox. And I didn't want to go in for 28 days, even though I had the insurance, but I didn't want anybody to know. So I went on vacation for 2 weeks and went there for 16 days. And they wanted me to stay longer, but that's as long as I'd stay, 16 days. Believe it or not, it worked for me. I never had another drink from that Saturday morning when I walked in there. Now, is that me? No, that wasn't me. That was God. It has nothing to do with me. I met some people while I was in there. It's a guy, tall guy. His name was Arthur. Where's Art? Arthur's here somewhere. Here's Art. Yeah, his name was Arthur. We didn't call him Art. We called him Arthur. He's about 6'3", black dude out of Philadelphia. He and I had probably one thing in common. We were both men. Other than that, we had nothing in common. Nothing. And that guy, out of all people in the world that had talked to me before, got through to me and got me to admit that I was an alcoholic. And he did it in 2 days. Because I was on an abbreviated program, remember? I had 16 days. I didn't have the whole 28-day deal. So I get up on that Monday morning, I looked in the mirror, and I was shaving, and I just burst out crying, saying, you're a damn alcoholic. You know, so I admitted that. I knew I was an alcoholic. Had no problem with that. What I wouldn't admit is that I didn't want to drink for the rest of my life. I figured, I need to work on this, and I need to figure out how I can stop being an alcoholic and how I can drink sociably, like my father did. You know, my father could have a couple of beers. On the weekend, he'd have a few drinks and some beers. He probably drank more than the average bear, but in comparison to me, he didn't drink at all. He was pretty easygoing. So I wanted to learn how to do that. I went to my while I was in there, they lied, told me I wasn't going to do it. All of a sudden, I'm getting B12 shots in the butt, and I'm getting all of this stuff. They tell me about my blood pressure. I hear the doctor outside the room talking to the nurse about my distended liver and going on and on. Like, who's he talking about? And then he leaves, and she comes in with this needle. Seemed like that big at the time. And she says, bend over, I got to give you a shot. I said, no, the doctor told me an hour ago I'm not getting any shots. She said, yeah, well, he just left, and he said, you're getting this shot. Now, do I need to call somebody to hold you down, or are you going to, you know, bend over and pull your shorts down? So then I get the B12 shot to start off with. And I found out they were talking about me. That was on Saturday. You know, by Monday, I'd finally admitted what was going on. So I went to my first meeting on the bus. Did you guys come in on the bus? Yeah. I got a call riding the bus. We went to my first meeting on a Tuesday night at North Wales, Pennsylvania. There must have been, God only knows, 100 people in the room because they had Al-Anon and AA and Alateen, and they all met in the big room. And then after they did the readings and everything, they all broke and went to their other rooms. You know, the Al-Anon went there and the Alateen went there and all that stuff. So I'm walking in on the bus, walking down the middle of this aisle and 100 people in the room, and I know that every one of them is staring at me and every one of them saying, hey, he's an alcoholic, yeah, he's an alcoholic. I didn't realize at the time everybody sitting in those chairs was going through the same thing. But it doesn't occur to you when you walk into that room. You think you're the only one. Mary back there, you think you're the only one. You're not. Trust me. Every other woman in here is going through the same thing. And I remember that. It's my wife's name, so I remembered your name. There was a guy in the meeting that night. He introduced himself as Richard. Not that big. Little guy. I don't even know what he said. He ended up becoming my sponsor for 24 years. It didn't happen right away, but 24 years he was my sponsor. He was a professor at Temple University. Prior to that, he ran the healthcare system for the state of Pennsylvania. We were like Mutt and Jeff. I mean, me, the gorilla that I am, and my voice, and him, this soft-spoken little guy, you know, and we went to Hilton Head for about 20 years playing golf every year, and everybody knew we were gay because all we'd do was walk around the malls. And, you know, there's two guys. And in Pennsylvania, it was the same thing. When we'd play golf all year, but then when the snow came, well, we couldn't do golf, so we did what we call mall therapy. We'd get in the car a couple of times a week, ride over to the mall, and just walk around the mall and shop and talk and do whatever we did. But it was just, we were together. He took me under his wing, as well as a group of people. And that's, when I got out of there, I didn't know anything other than where the bus took me. So I went to those meetings for a week, called it following the bus. Those are the only meetings I knew. So finally, he got together with me one night and said, here's your schedule. I said, what do you mean, here's my schedule? He says, well, this is your schedule. On Monday night, you're going to go to a step meeting, you're going to St. Dunstan's, and that starts at 8 o'clock. On Tuesday night, you're going to go to North Wales. On Wednesday night, you're going to go to Cedars Men's Group. On Thursday night, you may have it off, but if I want you to go somewhere, I'll tell you. On Friday night, you're doing the men's group again. On Saturday, you're going to St. Mary's. And on they booked me. It was a tour. I was booked solid every day, and I wouldn't dare let them down. And after every meeting, we went out to a place called Friendly's. Ever hear of Friendly's ice cream? Yeah, well, Friendly's, hamburgers, ice cream, milkshakes, whatever. I put on more weight and God, I has pills. I finally lost weight in the rehab and then I put on 20 pounds. We went out every night. A night for me for a meeting was I left the house at 5 o'clock, maybe 5:30, because they had me making coffee. And in those days, we didn't have those little things. We had the 100 cuppers. They took an hour to brew. So in order to have the coffee ready a half hour before the meeting, you had to be there an hour and a half before the meeting. So then the meeting would get out at 9, and by the time you cleaned up and get out of there and then went to Friendly's and then got home, it was kind of like 11 o'clock. So I'd leave for a meeting at 5:30 and come home at 11 o'clock, all the time. And in the beginning, my wife said, you know what, these meetings don't last that long. I know how long a meeting lasts. What the hell are you doing? So she followed me one night. And there I was, over in Friendly's, right where I said I was. I think for about the first 5 years, every time she'd kiss me, she'd breathe in. Serious. Serious. She went to Al-Anon meetings and told the people in Al-Anon. Well, those of you that know Mary, I mean, you got to picture her doing this. It was her time to chair an Al-Anon meeting, and she'd only been going for a little while, so she put little notepads out in front of everybody and pencils and all of this stuff, and she had the music playing, and she was going to... Oh, yeah, she's reading this stuff from some shrink doing something, you know. And these women were very nice. They sat there and listened to her for about 5 or 6 minutes. And finally, one of them said, Mary, we don't do that. This is not what we do. Well, she went on and became an Al-Anon guru and helped a lot of women, really did. My son became the state chairman of Alateen for the state of Pennsylvania. That's a pretty big deal. That's a big state. There's a lot of kids. It was the Pittsburgh group, the Philadelphia group. They'd get together. We had Valley Forge Park one time. I had 300 of them out there, and I did a cookout for 300 kids. And because I was a restaurant guy, and I could do all of that stuff. And our family got immersed in AA, in Al-Anon, and Alateen. And that's pretty much what we did. To get back to where I was, there were my sponsor said, sobriety's like a three-legged stool. And he called it fellowship, acceptance, and service. And he said, you knock one of those legs out, you're going to fall over. You can be on a three-legged stool, but you're not going to be much on two. You're always going to be teetering back and forth. So they got me involved in the fellowship immediately. A group of guys took me under their wing, and they really did. We played golf. We did everything. We went everywhere together. I didn't have a friend in the world that wasn't in program. Not because I planned it, but because they just wouldn't let me do anything else. Everybody brought me in, and it was great. He used to tell me, pray for acceptance. I didn't know what the hell that meant, pray for acceptance. Accept what? I don't want to accept the fact that I'm an alcoholic in the beginning. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I used to go to meetings, and all these women were sitting there all dressed up and smiling and laughing, and I was like, you know, I don't want that. I want to be able to, what's the secret? Well, you know, at what point can I get happy? This went on for about 5 or 6, 7 months. And finally, another fellow taught me to pray for acceptance. And I said, what do you mean pray for acceptance? Just accept the fact you're an alcoholic. Quit fighting it. See what happens. I said, well, I don't pray that much. Remember, I was born and raised Catholic, went through grammar school, went through high school. You know, I mean, taught religion, taught CCD in my home. I don't pray. Well, I didn't. AA got me back to prayer. So he said, when he talked about the prayer and acceptance, he says, well, what do you do when you get up in the morning? I said, what do you think I do? I get a cup of coffee and go on a jog. That's what I do every morning. He says, well, why don't you pray first? I says, I'm going to forget. You know, I just had every excuse in the world. He says, what you going to do? You wear slippers? I said, oh, yeah, I don't like walking barefoot. I got to wear slippers. He says, put the slippers under the bed. I said, what the hell are you talking about? He says, when you kneel down and get your slippers, you're going to be on your knees. You don't have any choice. It's the only way you're going to get your slippers. And maybe that'll get you to pray. You know what? It worked. Stupid. But it worked. It got me down on my knees, at least on one knee, and then I couldn't reach them, so I got down on two knees, and now I'm on my belly reaching for my slippers because I kicked them in too far, and then I said, oh, I'm supposed to be praying now. Wow. Today it's different. Today, I still do the coffee. Now I got to let the dogs out. Then I go to the John, and I've got my readings in the John on my own little table right there. So that's the first thing I do. That's my readings. Well, first thing I do is make my coffee. I got to admit, I do make my coffee first. From there, they got me to be... Oh, that was funny. They had me making coffee. I made coffee for 6 years for that group. 6 years I made coffee. Oh, I was a restaurant guy. What are you going to do? They had me making coffee. And I'll forget, it was like year five, we were having a business meeting. We had them once a month. We had them once a month. And whatever it was, they asked for the coffee something, and I was treasurer at the time, I guess. Somebody said, how much we spend on coffee? Nothing. What do you mean, nothing? I said, I just take the coffee from work. Say what? I says, yeah, I bring the coffee, the sugar. All we had was Sweet and Low at the time. There was no Splendor or any of that other stuff. You know, just I bring the coffee and all that stuff and the cups and all. I bring that from work. He said, I says, well, they donated. He says, Ray, you don't steal the coffee for the group. We're self-supporting. How many years you been coming here? I said, well, obviously not long enough. I'm thinking I'm doing something. Thinking I'm doing something good, and you're telling me that I'm stealing coffee. I never thought of it that way. I thought I was helping the group so we can send more money to inner group and, you know, all that stuff. And they said, no, we take care of our own expenses. So anyway, I stopped stealing coffee. But from there, I was there, and then I was a group chairman, and I was a GSR, and I had a DCM, and I went through all of that stuff. You know, which now I look back on, and it was pretty important. It's pretty important. Some of the things we did for meetings. A couple of you might have heard this before, but there were two calls that I remember in particular. A friend of mine named Chris. Chris and I used to do 12-step calls together. And we did a prison meeting one time at Greaterford Prison in Greaterford, Pennsylvania. Where else would Greaterford Prison be? So we drive up one night in his truck. We get to the prison gate, you know, we park the truck, and we walk in, introduce ourselves. Yeah, we're here to do a meeting. They finally let us in, and then you hear these, you know, it's not like jail, it's not like Cherokee over here. I've done probably 100 meetings in Cherokee. That's a jail. A prison is different. When those gates shut, it's a different noise altogether. It is loud and it is scary when those gates close behind you. So we go through the first set of gates and I'm like, wow. We keep going in. We go through the second set of gates. Same thing. We take a couple of steps and some guy from back there who's wearing a uniform lets out a yell, "Who owns that blanking truck out there?" And Chris is like 6'5". And he turns around and says, "Me." He says, "Get that damn thing out of there. It's covered with ladders." We had driven right up to the wall and just parked. And he's a painter, you know, roofer. He's got 15 ladders. You know how they're all stacked up? All stacked up. So he has to go back through these two gates. I am alone. And then they bring me through the third gate and into this room, and this is where the meeting is, and there's 30 guys in there, and every one of them looks nasty. I mean, none. I was a prima donna. I mean, these guys did not look like anybody I wanted to hang with. It was my first time in a jail, a prison, or anything. And I went in there, and I was kind of nervous, really nervous. And it took him a long time to get it, you know, by the time he went through the gates, and then come back, and then go through the gates again. I was probably in there alone for 10, 12 minutes. It seemed like a lifetime. It turned out to be a great meeting. The guys were fantastic. It was good. But, you know, all the projection and fear and all the stuff that goes on in your stomach, that was fun. Another 12-step call we went on, his wife, Aileen, says to Chris, "Hey, my girlfriend, whatever her name was, her husband is having problems and want to know if you and Ray can, you know, stop by and talk with him." Well, we were young and stupid, and we didn't know. We probably had 3 or 4 years in at the time. And, you know, we're still setting the world on fire, and we're fired up with all this AA stuff. So we said, yeah. So we, after the Friday night men's meeting, we'll go over 9 o'clock. So 9 o'clock, it is downpouring rain. I mean, you can't see the end of the room. It's pouring. Porn. We get to this house and we walk in, and the girl's there, whoever she is, his wife's friend. And Chris knew her, I didn't know her. And she says, "You guys want some coffee or whatever?" "Yeah, we need more coffee. It's 9:30 at night. We've been drinking coffee all day, all night." Yeah, we need coffee. So off she runs into the kitchen to go make a pot of coffee. Guy's sitting on that end of the couch. Chris sits on that end of the couch. I sit in the chair. Chris starts talking AA. You know, you got a problem with drinking, is there something? This guy looks at Chris, then he looks at me, and he looks back at Chris, then he looks back at me, and he reaches down on the couch and picks up the biggest damn gun I have ever seen in my life. I mean, it was a .45, but it looked like a cannon. And he pointed it at Chris, and he pointed it at me, and he said, "If either one of you has ever stepped foot in this house again, I will blow your heads off." And we laughed. We never got the coffee. It was just weird. And then we found out later, no, you don't go because the wife wants you to be there. You know, if the guy doesn't want to get sober, you don't do that. We're a program attraction. We don't do that stuff. You don't go on those kind of calls. You may go into a hospital and try and walk around and talk to the wards if you want, like they used to do way back when. But you don't go to somebody's house unless that guy wants you there, especially in his house with his gun. Now, that's the funny part. The sad part is, about 3 months later, he blew his head off and left a wife and 4 kids. And right in his living room on that same couch, he put a gun in his mouth and blew the back of his head completely off. And, you know, that's the sad part. That's what that disease did to him. And he just wasn't ready. But he scared the hell out of me. My shorts were, it was a bad night. It was a bad night, I'll just say that. About beginning of April 3rd, April 4th, whatever, it's a Friday. I was in my yard and had a guy talking. He stopped by. We're talking about taking down this tree, taking down that tree, whatever. There's a dead branch hanging from a tree, about 6 inches out of my reach. Can't reach it. I jumped up, grabbed the branch. The damn thing looked like it was coming down on my head. So I start backpedaling. I lose my balance. land on my butt, my head goes back, and I smash it on the concrete. Big pile of blood. Couldn't remember things for about 2 minutes. I said, I'm okay, you know, I'll just put an ice pack on it. And he says, listen, I'm either going to call your wife, because she was at the vet's, and I'm going to call the ambulance. I said, you better call my wife. So she comes home. By then, I've got the ice pack on it, you know, and I'm sitting in a chair. And I was finally remembering who I was, and I was okay. So we go to the hospital, Cherokee, Northside. They put 4 staples in the back. I got a fracture here. I got a blood spot in the front of my brain. It was a lot more serious than I thought it was. And the next thing you know, they're going to put me in an ambulance. They're going to bring me down to Northside in Atlanta because they don't have a neurologist full-time up there that's going to be there to monitor me on Saturday morning, and it just goes on and on and on from there. So the next thing I know, I'm in Northside, Atlanta at midnight, and they're admitting me. And I'm in bed with a towel on my pillow and blood all over the darn place. I looked like a mess. And I was okay with that. I was all right with that. So about 3 o'clock in the morning, I got to pee. Bad. I'm all hooked up. I got all this stuff on me, my arms. I got a blood pressure cuff on me. So I push the button. She's at my bedside inside of 5 seconds, maybe 6. She says, what's the matter? I said, I got to go to the bathroom. She says, okay, I'll unhook you. So while she's unhooking me, I said, you know, you got in here awful quick. I said, you know, how'd you get in here so fast? Because my mind works like that, you know. How the hell did you get in here so fast? Like, that's the biggest thing on my plate. She says, well, I only have 2 patients. I says, how's Northside going to make any money if you only have 2 patients? She looked at me and she says, I don't think you realize just how bad your injuries are, do you, Mr. Champagne? I said, no, I guess I don't. I says, but I guess you don't realize I should have been dead 36 years ago. So this is no big deal, you know? And she looked at me. Well, then we got talking later on over the period of 4 days. 4 days I was there. They wouldn't let me go because this little blood spot kept changing shapes, but it wasn't getting any bigger. And they kept saying, no, everything's fine. I said, good, let me go home. No, we want you to stay another day, you know, because we want to make sure, My final CAT scan was 3 weeks ago, and it's perfect. And it's got a little scar tissue there, and he said, that's not going to be anything, but exactly what I thought, everything was absorbed back in. He gives through all this stuff. Turns out, anyway, talking to this nurse, that she got a couple of people in her family with AA problems, with alcohol problems, and, you know, we got into some stuff, and, you know, you never know who you're talking with. You just never know. It was another funny thing. About an hour later, I finally nodded off for just a second. I guess my head went down. And next thing you know, she's running in there again. I said, What's the matter? She said, well, the alarm went off. You weren't breathing. I said, obviously I was breathing. I'm still here. She says, No, you weren't breathing. I says, well, I put my head down and probably cut off my oxygen supply for a little bit. She says, well, do you use a CPAP machine? I said, yeah, I have for a few years. God's honest truth. She says, did you bring it with you? Now, I'm laying in bed, my feet up, you know, I'm all hooked. I said, yeah, it was the first thing I thought of when they were loading me in the ambulance. Yeah, let me go home and get my CPAP machine because they're going to need that when I get downtown. So then she hooked me up with oxygen, and that was great. You know, that's all it was. My oxygen level dropped down. The doctor calls me an effing miracle. His assistant looked and said, I've never heard him talk like that, ever. I said, well, he hadn't met me before. I bring out the best in a lot of people. So I went through all this stuff. I've had 7 CATs. I call them CAT scans. Now they call them C scans. I guess they don't like to put the extra 2 letters. I don't know. But everything's perfect, and I'm doing great. And actually, I lost some more weight, and I've gotten healthier since that. But it was another close call, and I can think of 4 times in my life that I should have been dead. I mean, really should have been dead. That may have been one of them, but, you know, another one, I was drowning and I got pulled out, and, you know. But when I stopped drinking, I couldn't have made it much longer. I was gone. My skin. By the way, once I stopped drinking, my feet don't stink. I'm telling you. Everything cleared up. I had a big on the back of my back, a cyst, you know, one of those fatty cysts. And I went to the doctor and he lanced it, and I said, why is that? I never had that before. He says, well, you know, When you stop drinking, your nerve endings go crazy. And your body's sending oil to places that it shouldn't be sending it, and it's sending this there. It's going to take months for you to get out of this thing. You know, it's just, so I believed him. I said, yeah, I guess, you know, here I am 33 years old and still getting pimples. Where's that coming from? But it was had to do with the fat glands and stuff, and, you know, doctors kind of figuring all this stuff out. I got one about 3 months later. This time I had my son lance it. I said, I'm not going back to here. It cost me too much money. That's crazy. Yeah, here's a razor. Hold it over the flame. All he did was just, boop, 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 done. I said, then my wife says, you are nuts. You're going to get an infection. I said, how am I going to get an infection? I sterilized the blade. Everything's great. You know, just, oh, Lord. I got so many funny stories. I go on forever. But, you know, the biggest thing and the serious thing is about how abusive I was to my wife and my son for all those years. I remember one time he must have been about 5 or 6 and she wanted to buy him an Easter outfit, and I went crazy because she spent $12 on an Easter outfit. $12? Are you kidding me? You know what I can buy for $12? You know, that was a bottle of booze and a six-pack of beer back then. So I used to pick on her for stupid stuff. I would get emotionally abusive. I would, not so much physically, but enough times that it was bad. Verbally abusive all the time. Financially abusive all the time. This disease turned me into somebody that I never would have thought I was. Now, granted, as I was going through it, I didn't see it. And when I first came out of it, I still didn't see it. I have trouble seeing it now when I look back. I still want to make excuses all this time later that it really wasn't that bad. And then when I look at the individual instances and the individual things that I did, it was pretty bad. It's easy to gloss over. It's so easy to look back and say, it wasn't that bad. You know, I'm a nice guy. Well, I might have been a nice guy, but when I got on my high horse, I was not a nice guy. And when I got on this thing with pornography, and that was only like 15 years ago, when the hell did the internet come out? The 90s? Early 90s? So, I mean, that was just horrible, and I treated her like crap. I'm going to wrap it up, but I want to wrap it up by going through a few things that I've learned, and I had to write them down because I don't remember all this stuff. So I've got some bullets here that I've learned in the program that I'm going to pass on because you may have heard them and you may not have heard them, but some of them are pretty good. I learned about the ism, the intolerable selfish me. I found out that alcoholism is about me being a pig, being selfish, you know, and it's not alcohol, it's alcoholism, and I have it, and I'm always going to have it. I found out there's a difference between facts and feelings, especially if you're new in the program. The fact is I'm an alcoholic. How I feel about it is going to change on a daily basis. I'm going to feel good, I'm going to feel bad, I'm going to feel upset, I'm going to feel a lot of things. But there's a fact that it's not going to change. My feelings are going to change every day. I learned that from a kid that had the program for 30 days. That's what he said. And I wrote that down because I said, 30 days? And he's, wow. He said, men's a giant. We never know what's going to come out of it, you know. I learned that we regress spiritually, mentally, and physically. And that's how we do it. First of all, as we're drinking, we lose it spiritually. Then we lose it mentally. And lastly, usually, we lose it physically. And when we stop, it comes back in just the opposite form. We get it back physically first, and then our mental acuity starts to come back, and if we're real lucky, the spirituality starts to come back. But that's, you know, that's the way it is, and that's the way everybody is, so quit fighting it. I quit fighting it. I learned that sobriety is a journey. It's not a destination. I'm never going to be, we got a debate going on. Am I sober? Am I, you know, all that stuff? Am I cured? I don't know. You read it in the book, it says, yeah, I'm recovered, it's on some page, and everybody else says I'm still recovering. I don't really care. Truth is, I don't drink today. So for today, I don't drink. And today's like, I forget, 13,000 something. I got a little app on my phone down here that tells me how many days I've been sober. It's pretty cool. This is pretty cool. I know I need to remain, and this I like, I need to remain fat. And I'm good at that. faithful, available, and teachable. I need to be faithful to the program. I need to be available to the new person to come in. And I need to keep learning. I need to be teachable. And that needs to stay. I also realize that AA is not for those that want it. And it's not for those that need it. It's for those that are willing to do the work. Now, there's a lot of people that want it and a lot of people that need it. And it just doesn't happen because they're not willing to do what it takes. And what it takes is to get a sponsor and work the steps and do all the stuff that we really know we need to do. We know that. Sometimes I get lazy, sometimes I don't. You know, I've had a bad string lately since, like, everybody I talk to, nobody, you know, they all say they want to get sober, but then within the day, they're cured. You know, as soon as that hangover goes away, or their wife gets off their back, or the boss stops yelling at them, or, you know, all of a sudden, they're fine. You know, you called me up last night at 10 o'clock, now it's 8 o'clock in the morning, and you're better. What the hell happened?
Yeah.
You know, it's been 10 hours, I understand. So what happened in these 10 hours? Oh, I'm all right, I'll call you later. I said, yeah, you do that. That was the last one. That was 2 weeks ago. He hasn't called back yet. All right. Lastly, oh, look at this. I'm pretty good here, Rick. You're going to be able to do your thing, whatever that is. This, I think, is so cool. Because, and remember, I don't make this stuff up. This one I may have. I don't know. I think I did. I think this is mine. We don't get everything back in one day. We really don't. But one day at a time, we get everything. Thank you very much.